the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Perry Gary presiding.
Go ahead and be seated. Good morning. All right. First matter up on our docket this morning. Docket number 49999, Diplomat Corporation versus Marvin Simon. Mr. Bird, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Right. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Bird. Together with Mr. Anthony Golden, we represent the appellant Diplomat Corporation in this matter. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
The issue in this case is whether or not the trial court misconstrued the stipulated settlement and order and improperly allocated certain costs to Diplomat Corporation that it would not otherwise have been obligated for, either under the stipulated settlement order or the lease obligations that were in place at the time of the settlement order. As a result of those inconsistent allocations of risks and inconsistent positions that the trial court took, the court refused to grant any contempt sanctions against Mr. Simon and award the actual damages and losses that Diplomat incurred for cleanup costs resulting from the contamination on the property. I think as a framework to understand what transpired at the time that the stipulated settlement and order was entered, it is important to understand that Mr. Simon was the person who was responsible for the contamination to this property. And the reason I say that is that this contamination didn't happen overnight. It occurred over a period of years. These were long-term ground leases, long-term subleases. And Mr. Simon essentially turned a blind eye to what was going on with the operations of his tenant, Mr. Razak, at the property. So under the contractual obligations in Mr. Simon's sublease, he was obligated to use the property in compliance with all laws, ordinances, and regulations. He was obligated to maintain the property. He was obligated to prevent any nuisances on the property. He was obligated to hold Rebel harmless from any loss or damage, Rebel being his landlord, from any loss or damage. And perhaps most importantly, he was obligated, he being Mr. Simon, was obligated to return the property in a good, clean condition at the end of the lease term. Likewise, Rebel, who is not a party to this appeal, but who is the tenant of Diplomat, was obligated also to use this property in accordance with all ordinances and statutes, was also obligated to hold Diplomat harmless from any loss or damage arising from the use of the buildings on the property, and was obligated to pay any costs or fees that Diplomat might incur.
Isn't what we're talking about here, though, simply the four corners of the settlement agreement?
It is, Your Honor, but the reason that the lease provisions are important is because those lease provisions were reaffirmed as part of the stipulated settlement and order.
But the terms of the stipulated settlement, specifically paragraph 3, is what I'm looking at, which really has the guts of this agreement. You're essentially claiming there was a breach of this agreement, and that's kind of what I'm interested in having you explain. And it was to be cleaned to enable a phase one report to be issued and to comply with, the reasonable expectations.
Yes. And what that effectively means and what the trial court found was that the requirement to clean the property to Diplomat's satisfaction, reasonable satisfaction, is what the term of the agreement required. The reason that the district court's interpretation and allocation of that risk was in error was because the first thing that the district court did in deciding this matter was to conclude that Mr. Simon was responsible for the entire cleanup, regardless of the scope or the cost, because of this unknown contamination that was on the property at the time the stipulated settlement was entered into. Once the court made that determination, and that determination has not been appealed from, so that determination is...
Where do you find that determination? It's not in the written order.
It's not in the written order, but it is a part of the court's...
It was
the transcript of the hearing.
The record at 1744, you cite twice for that in your briefs, but the problem I have with that is the court was engaging you in a discussion at that point. It was not articulated as a finding of the court, nor was it carried forward into the written record. And I don't see that. That seems to be an important piece of your argument, and I'm having trouble understanding from that page of the record that proposition. I don't think it's there.
Well, that proposition, though, without that fundamental proposition, there would be no basis for the trial court to enter an order which didn't allow... Let me back up. The reason that proposition is fundamental and is incorporated, at least implicitly, in the trial court's order was because the trial court ruled that any contamination that had been on the property prior to the time of the order couldn't be brought to recover any monies for that remediation, and that any claims with respect to that were waived. But it left in place the fact that Mr. Simon was, as was Diplomat, unaware that this contamination existed. So in not reallocating the amounts that Mr. Simon paid for the cleanup, it's implicit in that the court found that Mr. Simon's obligation was to completely clean the property and pay for it.
Simon did more than he needed to, but the court didn't order him to do more, nor did the court make a finding of that in its written order. If you can direct me to where in that written order or where in the settlement agreement Simon has cleanup obligations that go on past April 1, 2005 for pre-existing environmental damage, I would appreciate it, because that's the problem I'm having. I read that settlement order to say you sued on this and your obligation is to clean it up as of April 1, 2005, and you get a complete release of claims up to that date. Now, if further contamination occurs after that date under the lease, Simon, you may have to pay for it. But there's a cutoff on the party's settlement agreement, and that's what I understood the court's order to be saying.
But in order to do that, the court first had to allocate the risks of this unknown contamination.
Where did it do that?
Well, it did that because it didn't reallocate the cost of the cleanup amongst the parties in some different fashion. I mean, it held that Simon was responsible for making the cleanup of the unknown damage that was done by the tenant, Mr. Razor.
Where does it hold that? That's my question.
Well, I think that, first of all, directing the court's attention to the stipulated settlement agreement, the fact that the property has to be cleaned to the reasonable satisfaction of the Diplomat is the first key piece of language.
But doesn't it go further than that in terms of, it says a reasonable satisfaction, but it goes on to say so that they can get their phase one approved for the... It's a phase one inspection.
Yes, Your Honor. It's a clean phase one. It's in that same paragraph 3 of the stipulated settlement. The significance of the phase one is that was necessary for Diplomat to obtain some loans that they were going to use and have the property as collateral. But the phase one only goes so far because there was the decision by the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection to not require a complete cleanup of the property in terms of the remaining contamination below the surface walls of the building.
But in the stipulated agreement, after you get past paragraph 6, the second, it is hereby, it is further ordered to Judge McCreed, except to set forth herein the claims, counterclaims, cross-claims between and among the settling parties are hereby dismissed with prejudice, each party to bear its own attorney's fees and cost. We have that proviso stuck right there.
That proviso is in there, Your Honor, but there are a couple things that the court needs to be aware of with respect to that. First of all, with respect to the lease obligations between Revel and Diplomat, all of those lease obligations that I mentioned are reincorporated under paragraph 1. It says all of the terms and conditions of the lease, and the lease is a defined term, that being the lease between Diplomat and Simon, shall remain in full force and effect. In addition, if the court would look at the pretrial order that was entered in this, the only issues between Diplomat Corporation and the tenants was, one, eviction for the known contamination that was on the property at the time, and two, a claim for damages for repaving the back area of the building behind Mr. Razek's shop. So that was a narrow claim with respect to what was being sought.
Let me direct your attention. I can focus a little bit more precisely on the thing that's concerning me. Paragraph 1 of the court's order denying the motion to be made whole,
yes,
which is in the record at 1714, lines 14 through 21, says, with the exception of those matters expressly set forth in the settlement and order dated April 11th, all claims relating to contamination or other property conditions existing as of April 11th, including not limited to each of the claims made and damages alleged in the motion, were released by Diplomat in the stipulated settlement. So if Diplomat had a claim for cleanup, the scope of which was indeterminate, and it released it effective April 11, as I understand Judge Bell's order, that release concluded those claims even though the extent of them was unknown. And why is that an incorrect reading of this order?
Because
that's the point that I'm interested in.
Because Judge Bell didn't take into effect the fact that the lease agreement between Diplomat Corporation and Revel Oil was reaffirmed. All of the terms and conditions were reaffirmed, which would mean including Diplomat Corporation being held harmless, being able to get back a clean property. And the district court didn't take into account the fact that there were no claims between Revel Oil and Simon adjudicating the respective lease rights between the two of those parties. So there was nothing to dismiss between Revel and Simon. So all of Simon's obligations to Revel remained in full force and effect, and the litigation had no impact on that whatsoever. Therefore, once the Diplomat Revel lease is reaffirmed in all respects as part of the settlement order, the fact that there is this undisclosed, unknown contamination is something that Diplomat Corporation is entitled to pursue and to recover for. That's the analysis that we tried to present in the brief. And that's the one point that the district court failed to acknowledge and failed to really consider when it released all of the claims.
See, Mr. Byrd, you wanted to reserve some time. You're down to a minute and a half. And I know we peppered you with quite a few questions, so I'm going to give you a couple of additional minutes for rebuttals.
Thank you.
I want to reserve that.
The issue with respect to the inconsistency, then, is that if the court determines that the NDEP standard is applicable for making a determination of whether it's been cleaned to reasonable satisfaction of Diplomat Corporation, that standard has to be applied uniformly. And the remaining soils that still need to be remediated, somebody has to pay for that. And under the original lease agreement that was reaffirmed and under the obligations between Simon and Rebel Oil, Diplomat was not the party that had to clean or pay for any cleanup. The fact that there is this cleanup cost is no different than if in a construction defect case that comes before you, there is an anticipated cost of cleanup. It's an estimated cost of cleanup. Whether that has caused any damage yet or not doesn't make any difference. The party gets to recover it because it's not their responsibility to have to pay for it. I submit that what should happen is that the trial court should have considered the lease obligations as part of the stipulated settlement in order, and that when it didn't, that was the reason it didn't assign any contempt sanctions against Mr. Simon. I would request that the order be vacated, that the case be remanded with an order of sanctions and a finding of contempt.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Burt. I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Walsh.
Good morning, Justice Perry-Gary, and may it please the court. Gregory Walsh on behalf of the Simon respondents. With respect to the environmental contamination existing as of the date of the settlement, what Mr. Simon was obliged to do was set forth in the settlement agreement, and I believe Justice Perry-Gary has correctly noted that. He was not obliged to do anything more. With respect to the notion that because the lease agreements were reaffirmed in the settlement agreement, there's somehow a new obligation that wasn't released, that doesn't hold water because the lease going forward is simply the lease going forward. To the extent that were claims under the original lease, which were brought in the complaint, those were released.
Were they very specific to the back parking lot and simply doing the surface repairs?
I believe you're...
Or were there other claims that were more specific to the contamination we're talking about here today?
I think they were less specific than that, actually, Justice Perry. I don't recall the exact... I did look at them last night, but I don't recall whether they were this focused as is set forth in the settlement agreement. Mr. Simon did more than what was required by the settlement agreement. He did it as fast as he could, and he did it at a much greater expense than he thought he was going to have to. Alternatively, even if in fact he had greater obligations than he intended or expressly included in the settlement agreement, for instance, taking out the slabs inside the building, taking all the soil out, placing the soil, replacing the slab, he did those with all alacrity as well. Under either circumstance, the district court properly refused to hold the man in contempt of court. The only question, I'll take issue with the notion of the question here, is whether the court misconstrued the settlement agreement. That's actually not the question before the court today. The question before the court today is whether the district court abused its discretion in holding Mr. Simon was not in contempt of the settlement agreement. And the posture of this case, though certainly important in all cases before the Supreme Court, deserves particular attention here because the petitioner chose this course of action. When the petitioner filed its motion to be made whole, there was not a single reference to the word contempt in that motion. In our opposition to that motion, we said, you know what, well, that looks and smells and feels like a breach of contract claim. You've alleged a bunch of damages. You say we didn't perform. You know, for the judge to rule on that, we're going to have a new case filed, discovery, and a jury panel to make those decisions.
So do you agree with Mr. Bird's request in his reply brief that even if Simon's excused from contempt, Diplomat is still entitled to bring an action for breach of the settlement and breach of the lease in order to be made whole for its damages? Do you think those claims survive this dispute?
I don't think that, those claims were brought here, or B, that this court needs to address that question since it's not brought before this court at this time. My opinion probably doesn't matter either.
Right, but your position is narrowly, we're looking at this purely in the context of a contempt proceeding, so that's the dispute before
that's
us.
That's what it is. I don't think I can expand it, yeah. nor can counsel. The lower court's contempt determination, of course, either way, is reviewed for abuse of discretion, and that's only going to be found if this court has a firm and definite conviction that the court below committed clear error, looking at the relevant factors. So what were those factors? Well, first of all, the district court would have to find that the person disobeyed an order that spelled out its obligations clearly, specifically, and unambiguously to know exactly what was being imposed upon them. The corollary of that, as we noted in the Vertex case, is that if Simon's action appears to be based on a good faith and reasonable interpretation of the court's order, he should not be held in contempt. Now, the crux of petitioner's motion, of course, is that Simon should have done more underneath the footings of the building than take out all the contamination he could without actually tearing the building down. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The stipulated settlement, first of all, said nothing about contamination within the building or the level to which Simon would have to clean it, or indeed even that it's his responsibility, but I'll leave that to another time. But the reason the stipulated settlement didn't speak to that contamination is because both parties acknowledged that it was unknown at the time. At trial, the principal issues regarding contamination were Izzy Razak's, that's the subtenant in the transmission facility, his poor housekeeping practices. In other words, it was dirty. At trial, they also discussed the asphalt's staining, where they saw some oil out on that property and they needed that cleaned up. Accordingly, if you look at the stipulation, at the stipulated settlement, Mr. Simon could no more know what his exact obligations are with respect to that unknown contamination than he could predict the next Powerball winner. For instance, here diplomats suggest they weren't reasonably satisfied. Even if we look at that amorphous standard of reasonable satisfaction of diplomat, that tells Simon nothing about what his exact duties are in order to discharge the cleanup that the diplomat would require. For instance, the diplomat here is suggesting they aren't satisfied. Well, the next shovel full of dirt that would have been taken out from that property would have undermined the foundation of the building. That's an entirely unreasonable position to take if they're not satisfied, particularly where NDEP has said, you've done enough, we're not going to require any further action. Second, in order for a petitioner to prevail below at the trial court level, they would have had to have proven by clear and convincing evidence that Simon somehow violated a specific order of the court. And in fact, the damages that they're claiming here are stigma damages and a series of incidental expenses, none of which are included in the stipulated settlement. I would like to go through them all. I'm sure I don't have time, but I would draw the court's attention to the motion at 893, which sets forth the damages they want, and the settlement at 502 of the record. There is no union of claim damages in the motion and the obligations of Simon in the stipulated settlement. And at the end of that stipulated settlement, the court has properly noted that there is a release of claims. With respect to the 90-day element, I wanted to address that as well, because Simon did take all reasonable steps within his power to discharge his obligations under the stipulated settlement, and that would defeat any contempt claim under the Crystal Palace case we've cited. Here's what he did immediately. He basically immediately, maybe within a week or two. One of his obligations was to evict Izzy Razak. Filed a motion to do that. One of his obligations specifically set forth in the stipulated settlement was clean up the oil-stained asphalt and patch seal coat the front parking lot area. He commissioned 702 Environmental Services to do that. At approximately day 30 to 40, here's what Simon had done. All the work in the rear parking lot, the oil staining, front patchwork, all done, all paid for, all certified by NDP as clean, no further action required. He obtained an order from the court evicting Izzy Razak. That order was effective August 31, 2005. Well, as soon as legally possible then, he went in. One day after that order was effective, on September 1, 2005, Mr. Simon entered the premises to do cleanup work that he was required to do, the housekeeping work as he understood. Unfortunately, it was at that time that all the contamination was discovered. What did he do then? He went out and engaged 702 Environmental Services to start cleaning out the property. After the contamination was discovered, he pulled all the hoists. He started taking the slab out. He took 7 to 15 feet of soil out, replaced it with a new slab. That work continued unabated from September 1 forward until it was completed, and a no further action letter and a uniform environmental covenant was recorded. On this record, and under these standards of both proof below and review here, there is no way the petitioner can demonstrate that Judge Bell abused his discretion. I pointed out for a purpose that they chose this route rather than go through a jury because we had raised it. Ironically enough, when we raised it, they said, "No, this is a contempt proceeding. It's not a breach of contract claim." And okay, fine, we'll play by those rules. Well, you know, now today, they want to more or less convert it to a breach of contract claim wherein the court's review is de novo. That's simply not the standard at issue today.
Would it be your position then that issue as to breach of contract wasn't litigated?
That's correct. The issue litigated, Justice Douglas, was whether Marv Simon and the Simon respondents were in contempt of the stipulated settlement.
So in terms of the order that the court indicated or issued, you would hold that, as it says, with the exception of these matters expressly set forth in the stipulation settled similar in order in this matter dated April 11th, all claims relating to contamination. So they limited the order only to those things that were raised, and likewise any cross claims or counterclaims that were raised in this action.
I think that's a fair characterization, Justice Douglas, of the court's order. When when Judge Bell was transferred from the case, or the case was assigned out of his department, the diplomat was adamant that Judge Bell should hear the matter. In fact, they filed a motion saying Judge Bell should be the one to hear this matter. He had presided over the trial and heard all the evidence. He went on a site visit with the parties. He ruled on a previous motion to compel enforcement wherein Simon's obligations were discussed. He considered the papers of petitioner and responded here, and declarations filed in connection with this, and made an order. In short, they argued that he was in the best position to make this judgment call. And it is, in fact, his abuse of discretion that's in question here. They are not now free to suggest, again, that this matter was really a breach of contract action so that the court can look at the district court's construction of the agreement de novo. That's not what's at issue. With respect to the notion that the court's determinations have been inconsistent, Justice Pickering, I think, correctly pointed out that there is no order in the record anywhere wherein Simon is responsible for all contamination cleanup costs. Instead, the order we have before us today is the judge's determination that Simon's done with what he has to do. That's what that order says. Simon has completed everything he needs to do. He needs to do nothing more than what's in the stipulated settlement agreement.
Well, for purposes of contempt, by your own concession, there may be some collateral issues that could be brought in a separate proceeding with respect to remaining obligations of Simon under that settlement agreement.
I can't foreclose those. I do think certain collateral estoppel may apply. They can certainly try to.
But that's for another proceeding to make that argument.
I agree with that, Justice Pickering. The fact that, well, again, there's no order that Judge Bell made that indicates Simon's responsible for everything. In fact, while there may be dialogue between counsel and the judge at a prior hearing, that's not a finding that can be appealed. It's, in fact, a finding that means nothing in terms of the law. It has no purpose. It cannot be used for any purpose. As well, the petitioner suggests that we didn't respond to an argument that they can enforce the current sublease or that they could file a later breach action. Again, that's not relevant because the issue here is whether the district court abused its discretion, but also it's not true. In two places, we did argue that point. We argued that the stipulated order, quote, also included each party's agreement, including diplomat's agreement, to dismiss all claims with prejudice and to bear its own fees and costs except as set forth in the stipulated order. That would, of course, include any breach claims they're talking about.
Well, counsel, you're starting to reach because you limited yourself before, so this is you're opening up another can of worms. You sure you want to go there?
Well, I may have maybe I'm not being clear. What I'm suggesting is that
we started with you wanting to limit this, and now you're expanding it. So it's either one or the other.
I was just addressing the notion that we didn't address it. We've addressed it. That's all I'll say on that point, then, Your Honor. In conclusion, throughout these proceedings, it's abundantly clear that the petitioners urged that it should have things both ways, that they want to keep nearly the double rent that they incorporated into the stipulated settlement, yet not have Simon's release be affected as to anything, that they want to keep the benefit of all of Simon's performance under that stipulated settlement, yet also then ask Mr. Simon to pay for stigma damages and incidental expenses that were never incorporated into the settlement agreement. And they insisted upon having Judge Bell make the decision and exercise his discretion below, and yet they don't want the standard of review that's applicable to that decision to apply today. Under those circumstances, we respectfully request that the court affirm the lower court's decision.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Byrd, you got 2 minutes to wrap up.
Thank you.
If the sole issue is truly contempt, then the order that the district court entered is overly broad because it forecloses, by its specific language, certain claims that would still be existent either under the settlement agreement or the lease agreements among the parties. Secondly, I think it's important to point out, with respect to what was actually litigated and what was unknown at the time with respect to the contamination. The reason that the extent of this contamination wasn't known is because Mr. Simon objected prior to the time of trial of any tests being conducted on the property that would have determined the full extent of the damage done by his tenant. So to the extent that there are...
Didn't your client accept that risk, though, by entering into the stipulation?
Accept the allocation of that risk, though, when one party is the one that prevents the other party from knowing the extent. I would submit, Your Honor, that...
Well, there was no showing that, based on reading this, that either party understood that there was additional contamination.
The point I was making earlier was Mr. Simon should have known. It was his leasehold obligation to be able to maintain that
counsel,
property.
Counsel, due diligence cuts both ways in terms of this assumption of the risk.
But he was out on this property, according to his tenant, every month to get the rent check. He was the one that was out there physically observing what was going on, at least on a monthly basis. So if we're going to allocate the risk of the unknown, it has to fall on the party that has the contractual obligation and then prevents the other party from establishing or fully ascertaining the extent of the damage. With respect to the order, I would submit that it is overly broad if contempt is solely the issue, and that we would be entitled at the very least to bring a separate action for our damages. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you for your good briefs and arguments today.